In 2002, director Sam Raimi and star Tobey Maguire reset the superhero genre with the world's favorite web-slinger.
In 2021, I try to prepare myself as we dive back into the world of Isla scotches.
The film is Spider-Man.
The whiskey is Cull Ela 12.
And we'll review them both. This is
the Film and Whiskey Podcast.
Welcome to the Film and Whiskey Podcast, where each week we review a classic movie and a glass of whiskey. I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And this week, Brad, we are calling an audible. We had spun the wheel of fate, the wheel of destiny, and landed on a movie from your list for season 5, To Catch a Thief. But I don't know if everyone out there is aware, Brad certainly wasn't, there's a little movie coming out that just came out this past weekend called Spider-Man No Way Home. It is anticipated to break like every opening weekend record ever. We're recording this on the Thursday before it releases, so who knows, it might flop hard. But in order to get those sweet, sweet clicks and all those listens, we decided to, you know, whore ourselves out to the system and do Spider-Man instead. Brad, we'll have to put To Catch a Thief on the back burner here.
Hey, that is all right with me, man, because honestly, I freaking love Spider-Man. And I also appreciate, do you remember when we talked about Star Wars, how for you, A New Hope isn't A New Hope, it's just Star Wars?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love the fact that this movie is just called Spider-Man.
Yep.
It's not The Amazing Spider-Man or have some sort of like commentary on how close he is to home. Like, we're just talking about Spider-Man here.
Yeah, they do seem to be getting more and more like proximity-based.
Yeah.
Spider-Man, 4 miles from home.
Spider-Man in the suburbs.
All right, man. Listen, I want to dive right in. I watched this at like, I don't know, 1 o'clock in the morning this past evening. So I am sleep deprived, but I want to talk about this absolutely bonkers film. You know, it came out almost 20 years ago now. And when it came out, it really did kind of reset the superhero genre. This movie and the first X-Men film came out months apart from each other. They were both huge hits. This was probably the bigger hit, and really it kind of took off from there. But Brad, you know, when this movie came out, the superhero genre in film was just dead. You had the Batman franchise, which kicked off in 89 with Tim Burton's Batman, and it was this kind of, you know, it was Tim Burton. It was kind of campy, but also like this weird gothic German expressionistic thing. It got really dark with Batman Returns, and then Warner Brothers said, hey, we want to go in a different direction. We want to make this more family friendly. Basically what Marvel's doing now. Like, they wanted to take all of the kind of, you know, the teeth out of that franchise. They gave it over to the director Joel Schumacher, who did Batman Forever and Batman and Robin, which are two of the campiest, worst movies I've ever seen. I cannot defend those movies. Dude. And effectively killed the superhero genre until this movie came out in 2002.
All I gotta say is the only Batman movie from the 90s that I've seen was the first one, which I guess was technically 89, I believe. If those movies are more campy than that one, then there is no hope for 1990s Batman at all. Because Haley and I watched Tim Burton's Batman might be one of the worst best movies I've ever seen in my life.
Well, that's a hot take for another day. We're here to talk about Sam Raimi's Spider-Man. And the reason that I wanted to set it up like that, Brad, is I think looking at this movie through the 2021 lens, this movie has all of that camp that we associated with the superhero genre. And also, like, this is kind of what you get when you hire Sam Raimi. Like, he made his bones in Hollywood being a horror comedy director. The Evil Dead franchise is all about, really, truly horrifying images that are mashed up in, like, outrageously funny ways. And he brings that to bear here. Now, again, it's like, it's a little more family friendly here, but there are moments in this movie that are meant to shock and to startle, but it's also designed to have that sort of campy wink, wink nods to the audience as well.
Yeah, there's a certain sense of, I don't know. The thing I love and can't figure out about Spider-Man is that it takes itself super seriously and yet seems to be winking at the fact that, yep, this is a superhero movie. Like, we understand where the tropes are just running mm-hmm. wild. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've been struggling to place this movie. Like, if you plotted out all of the superhero movies of the last 30 years, right, on a spectrum, and, like, way over on the left, you have, like, the campiest of the campy, Batman and Robin. And way over on the right, you have the most sullen, dour, you know, Batman v. Superman, right? And I think in both extremes, you kind of hit a zone that I would label like, okay, bro. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You're taking this way too far. I don't think this movie drifts into the okay, bro zone. But, you know, like if there's a middle point, I think this falls a little bit on the campier side, whereas most of what we're seeing today in the Marvel universe is definitely on the right-hand side of that, where they want it to be at least somewhat grounded. You know, if they're going to have humor, it's a very particular kind of humor. And I think the success of the MCU has kind of trained people to look at movies like Spider-Man and think like, oh, it's so campy, I hate it. When in reality, like, I just think that we're so used to superhero movies being delivered to us in a certain way over the last 10 years that maybe you just kind of have to open up your mind a little bit to the fact that, like, ultimately this is, you know, as Patrick Willems says about the Star Wars franchise, like, this is based on a comic book that was made for children. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And I think it kind of hits that tone really, really well.
Yeah. This was the first time, Bob, maybe not the absolute first time, but one of the first times I ever felt my age.
Mm.
Like, in watching this movie, I realized I was saying to myself, man, kids just don't get how cool this was in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately following that thought was, damn, I'm old.
Yeah. No, this is like legitimately, that's how people that were around for Tim Burton's Batman felt about that movie. And I watch it now and I'm like, what the hell is Jack Nicholson doing? Like, why are they playing this Prince song in the middle of the movie? What's going on? And I've never connected to that movie, but I absolutely connected to Spider-Man. And so I'm in the same boat as you. Like, I am sure that some of our younger listeners, I'm thinking even of a couple of our Patreon patrons that we interact with, probably are not huge fans of this movie because they're used to the MCU version of a Spider-Man or just of superheroes in general.
Yeah, and I will give credit where credit's due. I think what the MCU does is that they really ground their stories in the emotions of their characters, in how Iron Man and Spider-Man and Captain America and Thor, like, where they are at in their emotional journey is reflected on the screen really well. And all of the action is kind of grounded in those things.
Mm.
And so I really love that about the MCU. I think that's where they really, really shine. And so when you come back to this Spider-Man, I think for me, this movie is incredibly grounded in the emotions of Peter Parker. I love that people in this movie call him Pete all the time. Like he's just their buddy. He, you know, it's his nephew. It's their friend since childhood. There's something about the way they interact with him that you feel the struggle that, you know, Tobey Maguire is going through as trying to be Peter Parker, but also trying to be Spider-Man and handle all these different things. And so all the campy stuff that kind of comes along with that doesn't take away from the emotional core of this movie. And so I almost enjoy the fact that you get some of the campy side elements that are amusing and entertaining, but you also still have an emotional core that is just spectacular.
Mm-hmm. All right, Brad, I think that we have hit the ground running here, but we need to pull back for a minute. We need to go into Brad Explains, the part of the podcast where Brad breaks down the film that he has just watched, often for the first time. That is absolutely not the case today. So, Brad, having seen this movie a number of times now, can you explain the plot of the film to our listeners in less than 60 seconds?
Can I explain Spider-Man? Let me think about it for 55 seconds.
Right.
So if you have just lived underneath the largest rock in the world for the past 50 years, then let me explain Spider-Man to you. It is about a high schooler named Peter Parker. He's on a field trip. He gets bit by some sort of radioactive enhanced spider. It fills in apparent blanks in his DNA that he didn't, you know that were there. And he becomes a superhero named Spider-Man. He's trying to get the girl of his dreams, MJ, the girl next door. He's best friends with this guy named Harry Osborn. Harry Osborn's dad is a scientist who takes some experimental drugs and becomes this evil bad guy named the Green Goblin. And they duke it out throughout the movie. Spider-Man has to accept his responsibility. His uncle dies because he didn't accept responsibility. And it's just a wild ride, Bob.
There it is, man. Oh, and you did it with 7 seconds to spare, too.
Boom.
All right, man, where do you want to start today? I mean, we can dive right into performances if you want, but I kind of liked where we were going with, you know, placing this movie in context, too. So, if you have more to say on that front, I'm happy to keep going down that road. Where would you like to go?
I mean, honestly, I think I'm going to capture both those things. I think that the trajectory of all superhero movies coming out of Spider-Man was set by the conversation between Uncle Ben and Peter Parker in the car.
Yeah.
Like, tell me that that little conversation didn't set the trajectory for all of the Marvel movies, for pretty much everything to come from them. I mean, even think about Batman Begins and, you know, the Christopher Nolan trilogy. It's all about him accepting responsibility for his city and caring for something that isn't caring for itself well. Like, I cried during that scene. It is so daggone beautiful. And the rest of the scene, out, you know, everybody knows the with great power comes great responsibility. The rest of that scene might be one of the best, like, father son advice, life advice conversations ever filmed in history.
So again, this is what you get when you hire Sam Raimi. Like, you have the purposeful campiness in parts. And I think that's what kind of sets this movie apart is you can tell when he's doing it on purpose. And then when it's time for like some really incredible shots or some really great drama or great dialogue, like, he knows how to frame that and he's not undermining those moments. Like, I was even thinking of right at the end of the movie where Green Goblin has, you know, Mary Jane in one hand and this like tram full of children in the other hand, and he drops them both and they cut to that shot of Spider-Man and you can see each one of them reflected in the eyes of his mask. And it's like, it's a preposterous shot. That's not how anything works, but it's like, holy shit, what a fantastic shot. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah,
dude. And I think that aside from just those kind of flashy moments, there's some really great filmmaking going on here. And they have a great cast. Like, this cast is stacked. And I realized even the later Spider-Man films, like the Andrew Garfield ones, it seems like Spider-Man just has a really great track record of nailing like incredible acting. You know, like the people that play Aunt May and Uncle Ben in the Andrew Garfield ones are Martin Sheen and Sally Field. And yet the reason that we don't remember them, to your point, Brad, is that that line, with great power comes great responsibility, is such a well-written line. And it is such like a catchy, you know, it's a catchphrase that when they had to have that scene in the Andrew Garfield movies, they had to like, they had to try to say the same thing, but they couldn't say quite the same thing. And it doesn't land as well. Like, it's just a perfectly written scene in that car.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I've never heard of Cliff Robertson or seen him in anything other than this, but he plays Uncle Ben. And he just, with the little bit of screen time he gets, he nails the father figure just perfectly, knocks it out of the park. Also, the part where he's talking about the computer jobs, he's like, computer this, computer engineer, computer software developer. I'm too old for computers. Bro, well, it's so good.
While we're here, let's go in on this a little bit, because this script is written by a guy named David Koepp, who is very famous in Hollywood, and he's written some of the biggest movies of all time. Like, he wrote Jurassic Park. He wrote the first Mission Impossible. And I feel like when you hire him, what you get is a almost perfectly structured movie, but maybe not the best dialogue ever. And I think part of that is just because, again, this movie was basing itself off of comic books. And this is absolutely the way people talk in comic books. But we've gotten used to more naturalistic writing in our superhero movies in the last 20 years. And so, like, listening to some of this dialogue, It's very bad, Brad. Like, it is not good. That scene
it's a little bit rough.
Where you're first introduced to Uncle Ben and he's like screwing in a light bulb and he is telling his wife, who knows what his job is, like, well, you know, when they laid off, what does he say about himself? I have it written down
here. The head electrician.
Yeah. When the plant lays off their senior electrician after 35 years of service, it's like, oh my God, like no one talks like this. Come on, man.
But if you took yourself out and imagined that as a scene on a comic book page,
yeah,
it immediately
it
makes
plays
sense.
Perfectly. Yep.
Also, Rosemary Harris as his aunt, May. Bro, when the Green Goblin breaks in and she's saying the Lord's Prayer.
Oh, man.
Dude, it is the most over-the-top, campy, perfect example of why you need somebody like her in this movie. Like when she's laying in the hospital bed and she's, his eyes, his yellow eyes.
Oh, man. I love it. So, Brad, while we're talking about Uncle Ben and Aunt May, this movie... We talked about how great the cast is. It has three people in it who have won Oscars for their acting. Can you name them? Or can you guess them?
J.K. Simmons.
Yep.
Did he win for Whiplash?
He did, yeah.
Okay, I figured. I don't think Willem Dafoe has won anything.
He has not.
He feels a lot more indie to me.
He's been nominated a few times, but yeah, never won.
Man, I'm looking through this whole cast. I'm not sure. Has James Franco gotten one?
He's been nominated. He's not won.
Okay. Then I don't know. J.K. Simmons.
J.K. Simmons.
Definitely Joe Manganiello, obviously.
J.K. Simmons. Cliff Robertson, who plays Uncle Ben, was actually, he won Best Actor back in the 60s. I don't know if you ever read when you were in high school. Did you ever read that short story, Flowers for Algernon? About
no,
the guy
I've heard of it.
Yeah, yeah. Like he takes like a medical serum and he becomes really smart and then it like reverses and he goes back to being like a really, he's like developmentally disabled.
No. That's Limitless, Bob.
Oh, I'm thinking of Bradley Cooper. I always get Cliff Robertson and Bradley Cooper mixed up.
Yeah, it's easy, man. I get it.
Anyway, they made a movie out of that story. He won Best Actor for it. And then the third one is actually Octavia Spencer, who won Best Supporting Actress when she was in the movie The Help, and shows up in this movie for like 4 seconds. And I was like, oh, hey, you went on to have a great career.
I noticed her in this.
Yeah.
I saw her for 5 seconds that she was, I mean, even that though, the fact that you have an Oscar, obviously not at this time, but an Oscar award-winning actress, like giving him advice on how to fight in a cage fight was just perfect. Like, she knocked that little role out of the park.
She sure did, man. Well, hey, let's talk about performances. We're already here. We've mentioned a few. I want to start at the top. Let's talk about Tobey Maguire. I think to this day, still my favorite Spider-Man. However, I think this time around, some of Tobey Maguire's limitations as an actor really stood out to me. I think he's a good actor, but there is a reason that you don't see him popping up a lot anymore. And it's kind of because he perpetually seems like a 18-year-old kid. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like he's like a 45-year-old man now. Also, he's kind of notorious for being just the biggest asshole in the world. Like I could tell you stories that I know just from Hollywood history of like movies that he's had buried and the poker circles that he runs in. He's notorious for being just a huge jerk. I've always thought he was a really good actor, and watching it through this time, I was like, you know, he's my favorite Peter Parker, but I think Andrew Garfield might ultimately be the better actor. Like if we're stacking up all three of the modern Spider-Men, I think Garfield might be better than him. Like just in terms of talent.
I will say I have never seen The Amazing Spider-Men.
They're not good. I don't like them.
I've heard that they're not great. At the time I was like in protest. I hadn't seen Spider-Man 3, and I was like, this is stupid. What are they rebooting things for? Like, just keep going. Just keep moving on with it. And so I never watched them. I will say that in this viewing, Tobey Maguire doesn't move his face very much. I don't know if that's like a very like technical note or not.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really show enough emotion
right.
a lot of times. And I realized that I almost get more emotion out of Tobey Maguire when he's in the Spider-Man costume.
Oh yeah,
because I think his voice carries a lot of emotion. Mm-hmm. And like his intonation, he delivers lines really well. But when you can see his face, it's not moving enough to like match the sadness or the mm-hmm. excitement mm-hmm. or, you know, anything else that's going on. So when that's covered by his mask, I'm like, oh, Tobey Maguire's like delivering a knockout performance.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I will say that I've always appreciated this movie as the origin story for Spider-Man. And I know that every time we get a new, like, Batman, we always say, like, I don't need to see his parents get murdered again. I know who Batman is. But with Spider-Man, I think one thing that I've always been kind of pissed about is that every time they reboot it, they don't do the origin story right. Like, I think this story yeah. really did justice to the origin of Spider-Man. And, like, they kind of do the same thing again in Amazing Spider-Man, just to lesser effect. And then with the MCU Spider-Man, I have never had any sort of emotional attachment to Tom Holland as Spider-Man because of the way they introduced him. Dude just showed up in Civil War and then they were like, all right, now he's part of the MCU. And you didn't get his actual origin movie until like a year later. And like, it's never worked for me. And I think this one just, it nailed it so much that they kind of just aren't trying anymore with the origin. But I think that's part of why I've never really liked the MCU Spider-Man.
I also struggle with his little sidekick. What's his name?
No, I don't know what his name. I know you're talking about.
It's like Fred or something.
Sure. That's what we'll call him.
Yeah. I never really enjoyed Fred at all. He's not my favorite. And so it just makes it hard for me to get real pumped about what's the actor's name who plays the new Spider-Man?
Tom Holland.
I've just never been the Tom Holland Spider-Man just doesn't get me in the mm-hmm. same way. Mm-hmm. Once again, I've only seen the first one, haven't seen it's Homecoming and then Too Far From Home.
And now it's No Way Home.
Never going to get
never
you back.
Never going home.
Yeah, never going home. So once again, I'm not an expert in the Spider-Man world.
Yeah.
All I can say is Tobey Maguire struggles a little bit when he's on screen without the costume.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so many areas where he does excel. And I really do think one of them is I love him and James Franco together. Because
mm-hmm.
I just think that James Franco is probably the best performance out of the three quote-unquote high schoolers. They all look like they're 27 mm-hmm. in their senior year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kirsten Dunst is fine. I'm not like overly impressed with her in this, but she's also not given a ton to work with.
She's not. And that's kind of why I think hers is the best performance. Now, Franco isn't given much to do either, except be rich and like conflicted about that.
But, kind of like, be a douche.
Yeah. But Kirsten Dunst is asked to have like these wild emotional swings of like, I'm in love with this person. No, I'm not. I'm in love with Spider-Man. No, I'm not. I'm in love with Peter Parker. And that's her whole character is just like kind of being an object, you know what I mean? And I think given that, she does a really good job with what she's offered on the page. They do a better job of like fleshing out her character in Spider-Man 2, I think. But even here, I think you can see glimpses and kind of see through the cracks in these characters with all three of these performers that there's more kind of untapped potential than what this script allows them to do.
Yeah, and I think that where you really see this script having its limitations is with the younger actors, Tobey Maguire, Kirsten Dunst, James Franco. But where you see people take this script and really run with it is in the older actors in this movie. We already talked about Uncle Ben and Aunt May, but dude, Willem Dafoe and J.K. Simmons, they just set their teeth into this script and rip it apart. And their performances, for me, are the highlight of this movie.
Willem Dafoe is so interesting because I've always wanted to just know, like, did Sam Raimi direct him, like give him direction to be more and more hammy? Or was this just a Willem Dafoe thing? Like, did he just think of this on his own? Because it gets so over the top. And yet, I never really got pulled out of the movie because of it. I think he completely understood the assignment, which was like, you're going to be talking to a mask and going insane about it. And then when you put the mask on, you're going to sound like you should be in a really bad 1940s gangster movie. And that's kind of like, he walks around going like, meh, Spider-Man. Like, that's his voice. But it works. It works for what this movie is trying to be.
And then on top of that, you have the emotional depth of that final line he delivers when he goes, Peter, don't tell Harry.
Yeah.
And then he like falls dead, like the most horrific falling dead I've ever seen.
But see, again, that you're right. The script gives him some really brilliant moments, though, as a character. Like, he has this whole speech to Spider-Man when he first kind of captures him and entices him with the possibility of, you know, join me and together we will rule the universe. Like,
yep.
He says this city is going to love you until they need to hate you, and then they're going to hate you. And it really is a precursor to exactly what you get in The Dark Knight with what the Joker's whole philosophy is. And I think it's an underrated kind of character development in this script. You know, and then they just give him like so many throwaway lines that, Brad, there's so many things Willem Dafoe does in this movie that I just want to implement in our podcast. Like,
like what, Bob?
Like when he's getting ready to take the serum and he just randomly rips off his shirt like medically unnecessary. He's like, I'm just going to get naked here. And then he has like our little whiskey sample bottles full of the serum and for no reason just chugs it and then slams it on the ground. Like when we sample whiskey from now on, I just want to chug it and then just, you know, and like he only has one guy there helping him. And he very clearly is making that guy like clean up his shards of glass. Like, why the hell did you throw that on the ground, Willem Dafoe? It's kind of a move.
That's what should have happened. He should have hit start on the sequence. And then when Willem Dafoe's heartbeat goes nuts, the camera like cuts back to the guy. And he's like
sweeping
he's sweeping up the glass shards into this little dust bin.
And then there's the other note that I took on Willem Dafoe is when he finds out that Peter Parker, you know, that Mary Jane is in love with Peter Parker and he's going to use that, you know, against Peter. He walks down the stairs to meet his son, who's kind of sad about the whole thing. And he says, like, you know, I've never been a good father. And then he looks him dead in the eyes and goes, I'm going to rectify certain inequities.
Right?
I'm like, well, that is chilling.
Dude, if I ever hear my dad say that.
Anytime you have like, an opinion I don't like on this show, I'm just going to offer that as a foreboding warning for the second half of the episode.
Oh,
Brad,
man.
We're going to rectify certain inequities.
Certain inequities. For me, Willem Dafoe takes the cake in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
I like, for all the things I've ever seen him in, he would probably be like top three on my list of actors I would like to interview for this podcast. I just think he is such a fascinating actor, and he's been in so many interesting movies. He doesn't seem super interested in the spotlight or being in like big, huge blockbusters, and he's just fascinating to me.
All right, man, I think we're in a really good spot to kind of hit pause, and let's try this Isla whiskey that we've got for today, Cull Ela 12. What do you say?
Dude, before we get there, I don't know if we're going to talk about him in the second half. J.K. Simmons the most perfect human representation of any comic book character ever.
When he plays
J. Jonah Jameson. End of story.
That's it. Every line reading, every biting of a cigar, it's just, it's perfect.
Dude, and like when the Green Goblin comes in and he's like threatening him, he's like, you know, tell me who's taking these pictures. He's sitting right there. But props to my boy J. Jonah Jameson doesn't give up my boy Pete.
No. So, true journalistic integrity right there.
That's what I'm talking about, man. And then immediately he's like, I knew it. You two are in cahoots.
Right. All right,
bro,
man.
Let's drink some of this Cull Ela.
Let's do it. All right, everybody. Today we are checking out Cull Ela 12-year. This is spelled much differently than it's pronounced, Brad.
Yeah, it looks like Cull Ela.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like Cull, maybe Saul, maybe it's a soft C.
C-A-O-L, Cull.
Yeah,
but it's Cull
Ela.
Cull Ela, yeah. So this is a distillery that is in the Isla region of Scotland. It's up in the northeast corner of the Isla region. It sits on the Sound of Isla. And the name they chose for the distillery means sound of Islay in Gaelic. Kalila. Fun, that's what it means.
Fun fact for some of you people out there, sound has multiple meanings. A sound is also, in addition to being, you know, auditory, it is also a body of water.
There it is.
Usually like a little strait of water between two landmasses.
You're telling me the sound of Islay isn't just what happens when you dump Lafroy into a glass?
That's it, man.
The glug.
It's the popping of the cork.
That's right.
It's the whole experience.
All right. So what we're drinking today is obviously a 12-year age-stated product. This is peated.
Whoa. You mean when they call it Cull Islay 12?
Cull Islay, bro. Get it right. Cull Islay.
Hey, but it's also made on the Islay.
It is.
It's an Islay scotch.
Yes.
Come on.
You're getting
it now. Understandable
You're
mistake.
Getting it now. All right, so this clocks in at only 86 proof, but we're going to see if it packs a punch at its low proof point. Brad, we have it poured out in front of us here. I can already smell the thing. It's definitely a peated scotch. What are you picking up on the nose here?
For me, it's got kind of a really nice, soft, peaty smoke to it that kind of gently covers this base of honey. And this is the first time I know for a fact I've ever given this nose note. Green bean. There's a little bit of honey and a little bit of green bean in there.
It's really funny you say that because I knew there was something vegetal about this and I just couldn't place it. And I was I thought maybe it was kind of oniony for a while or, and I definitely wrote down maybe there's some dill in here. There's something, not just herbal though. Like it definitely has a vegetable kind of smell to it.
It's almost like a snap pea. Like when you take like a green bean, like a raw green bean and you snap it in half.
Yeah. You know, that's a really good one because it has the sweetness of like a sweet pea as well, too. Like the note that I wrote down for this, there's a 1792 expression that's called sweet wheat. I wrote down sweet peat. Like that's what I get on the nose here. It smells like it has some sweetness to it, but I wouldn't call it honey sweet. We'll go with sweet pea. That's what we're going with here, folks.
It's kind of like when Orbit gum went from just having like peppermint or spearmint, and now they have sweet mint.
Sweet mint. Yeah. That's it.
That's it.
So I'm going to give it a 7.5 on the nose. I know we're probably not selling this to the listeners with our notes of green bean. But
here's the thing. I was reading the notes online from various reviewers for this to my wife, and her facial expressions, they're like, soft green vegetables, medicinal, oily. And my wife is like, those are not the things you want to drink. And I'm not disagreeing with her at all. I don't want to drink a green bean.
Yeah, I don't know if soft green vegetable sounds in any way appealing.
It's so gross, man.
All right, I'm at a 7.5 on the nose. Brad, where are you at on the nose?
I'm actually right there with you, 7.5.
When it comes to the taste here, I'm anxious to hear what you think because it has a very thin mouthfeel. You know, it's 86 proof and it feels every bit of that. Like it's very watery. However, I think it packs a little bit of a punch, both with the alcohol delivery and also with the peat. The peat is really, really strong on this one, but I think it complements it well. Like it's not overwhelming and it isn't off-putting. I think if I am going to ding this one a little bit though, Brad, I think that the amount of smoke here, it's kind of covering up for a lack of complexity in the flavor. It's very one note. It's just kind of blandly sweet and thin. And then you get a really nice layer of smoke. But I think that smoke is working really hard to cover up the fact that this is kind of a pretty simplistic whiskey.
See, I'm actually in a pretty different spot for you, Bob. I wrote down three words for my tasting notes, and I'll give them to you. They are prosciutto, honeydew, and herbs.
Okay. This was copy pasted from someone online. In my days have I known you. I don't even think I knew that you'd ever had prosciutto before,
Bob.
Prosciutto and honeydew. Come on, bro.
I'm a classy individual, Robert.
Yeah. All right,
dude. Have you ever had prosciutto?
Absolutely,
Barberton.
Absolutely,
Mr. Barberton over here.
Fuck you.
Trying to talk to me about who's classy or not.
All right, go on. Point taken.
No, so honestly, to me, this was kind of a chewy, meaty type of palate There's a little bit of a like a soft fruit on it that to me tastes a little bit like honeydew. Mm-hmm. Maybe like a grapefruitish flavor.
Hmm.
But then it was a little bit herbal, a little bit medicinal. And then, yes, there's a lot of smoke. For me, I kind of put my smoke more towards the finish rather than on the palate. But yeah, it's peaty. There's a lot of stuff going on. I gave it an 8.5 on the taste. I really enjoyed the flavor profile of this Kol Ila.
I'm only at a 7 on the taste. And I actually think that the finish is just about in the same spot. I'm going to give the finish a 7 as well.
It's because you didn't get the prosciutto note, man.
I know. If only I had gotten that prosciutto.
At least to an 8, man. Come on.
I'm getting more of a capicola, actually. So,
I mean, you married into an Italian family, man. You got to know your meats. Dude.
Listen, so the finish is nice, but I don't think it's anything special. And actually, I thought the finish was kind of boozy. So again, for only being 86 proof, the alcohol really does make itself known here. It had a really nice warming effect on the way down. So the finish was very pleasant. Again, I just think that smokiness and that alcohol tingle is kind of covering up for the fact that the whiskey itself didn't have a ton of flavor to me.
Man, for me, the finish was really nice. That is where it really stood out to me. There's a lot of smoke and pepper going on with little bits of tobacco. I really liked the finish a lot. I'll give it a 9.
Wow. Yeah, we're going to be in vastly different places on this, Brad. When it comes to the balance, I'm going to give it a 7.5. I think this is a really solid whiskey, but it's just not really blowing me away. And I think the standard for these kind of peatier whiskeys was set by the Laphroaig Lore that we had a few seasons ago. That one really just had layers and layers of complexity to it. Again, I know this is kind of like Kol Ila's baseline offering, but it just doesn't stack up in my opinion. So it's a 7.5 for me.
I'm in a similar spot. I give it an 8 out of 10 on balance. A little bit disappointing on the nose, but it picked up pace by the end of it. So I'm down with it overall. And I think that when you look at the value of this whiskey, in the state of Ohio, you can get Kol Ila 12-year for $69.99. For me, I think that puts it as it's a really solid entry into that kind of affordable tier of like peated single malt scotch. I feel like a lot of those get into the triple digits really quickly. So for $70, it's a really good offering. I'll give it a 7.5 out of 10 on value.
I'm going to give it a 6.5. I don't think that this is a bad value at all, especially for a 12-year age-stated scotch. You know, we talk all the time about how scotch is just in a different kind of pricing structure and tier than your standard American whiskeys that we would get here in the States. So it's a 6.5 for me, and that's taken me, Brad, to a 35.5 out of 50. Where are you coming out?
Oh, I was expecting lower from you. I'm at a 39.5. So we're only 4 points apart.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So we're coming out to an average of a 37.5 or a 75 out of 100. Brad, do you recommend?
Yeah, I do. I was saying to you before we got into the whiskey segment, Bob. I don't know what it is. I always, every single time we drink a peated scotch, I'm in. I genuinely enjoy the experience. But for some reason, I don't think I have ever once thought to myself, you know what I'm going to drink tonight? Give me that heavily peated scotch. That's just what I want to drink. I don't know what it is. It's just never a style of whiskey I reach for when I'm just going to drink for pleasure.
Yeah. Well, I think that meatiness that you were talking about kind of gets at it, too. Like, usually when I'm drinking a whiskey, it's after a meal. It's like when I'm winding down for the night. And I feel like there's just such a heaviness to, you know, peated scotch. It's that briny character. It's, you know, the prosciutto that we're talking about.
Yeah.
It feels like you're eating a whole other meal. And it's kind of like work to get through them. So I'm with you. It's hard to just kind of naturally be in the spot where you're like, yeah, let's totally do the heavily peated scotch right now.
Exactly. Yeah, but honestly, like I said, I'm nearly at a 40 out of 50, which is a phenomenal score. Not many of our whiskeys hit this point. So yeah, I definitely recommend buy a bottle, buy a dram at your local bar. Bob, how about you? Would you recommend?
I'd recommend trying. I don't know there are other scotches that I think I'd recommend buying a bottle of at $70, but this is certainly, like, it's not a bad experience by any means.
Yeah, I would say the Port Charlotte that we tried, I really liked a lot. That was a good one. So, yeah, the Lafroig Lore. So, yeah, there's definitely other, you know, peated options out there for you if you're looking to try it. But, man, this is a good one. Get into it.
All right, Brad, what do you say we carry this positive energy back into talking about 2002's Spider-Man?
Let's get to it.
All right, that was Kul Ela 12, a whiskey that we both liked a lot, Brad. Good
stuff.
Yeah,
man, I am just such a big fan of almost all the peated scotches that come out. I love all the ones we've had so far, which is like, what, three?
yeah, that's true. I am always...
Just about.
I'm always cautiously optimistic with them, but they're just so unique. It's hard to describe. Not ever unpleasant, but something that you really have to prepare yourself for.
Yeah, I'm with you. You really have to be in the right mindset to drink a peated scotch.
All right, man. Listen, all of my notes on this movie are just kind of like random thoughts. There is no cohesiveness to them at all. So I think we should just kind of talk about whatever comes to our mind here in the second half. And I want to go back to something that we were discussing in the first half about the origin story here, because I didn't grow up reading comics. Did you? Were you a big comic book person?
No, I actually, the only comics I ever read out of a comic book were Calvin and Hobbes.
Who do not show up in this movie, unfortunately.
They don't.
What I understand is that Spider-Man, the character, now I might be wrong on this, but what they do with him in this movie, getting bitten by a spider and then like being able to physically shoot webs out of his wrists, is not something that's original to the character. Like, what they're doing in the MCU where he has machines that shoot webs like out of his suit is actually what Spider-Man is canonically. I have no idea if that's true or not. I might be completely wrong, but I actually, because this was my first exposure to Spider-Man, seeing this movie, I like that Spider-Man has that superpower. Like, I hate when we just have guys build fancy suits and the suit is their power. It really just kind of pisses me off. It's why, like, Batman's cool, but I'm interested in the people that actually have to manage having super strength, or like, you know, the Hulk is a really compelling character to me. And so I like the fact that they had Peter Parker get bitten by this spider and then develop like this kind of gross body horror thing where webs just come out of him. That's really cool to me.
Yeah. I mean, really, Batman should be the least interesting hero in today's like economic climate. I feel like movies about a billionaire deciding how to spend his billions of dollars wouldn't be very like attractive to the general public. But hey man, everybody loves themselves some Batman. Like, I wish that they had a movie of just like him like moving his finances around and like playing the stock market. Like, that's actually the real
just
Batman.
The Wolf of Wall Street, but then once in a while he just like beats up a guy in an alley.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, so here's my big question, though, Brad. So Tobey Maguire gets bitten by this spider and then just nonchalantly shakes the spider off and it crawls under like a rolling, you know, cart or something. What the hell happens to that spider? Like, is it just biting more people? Are there other spider people out there now? Because it seems like that spider can just go on feasting for forever. And every time it does, like, we just have a new superhero out there.
Yeah, no, in my headcanon, that cart gets moved like the instant the camera moves away from it and just crushes it under one of the wheels.
Like, why didn't he just step on it? If a spider, I don't care how prized that possession is. If I get bitten by a spider that large, like, that thing is dead. I'd be like, oops.
Yeah, yeah. No, 100%. The other thing that got me about that scene was like, how did the computer know that a new species got created? Like, is this like a mechanical spider where they're like tracking every single bit of its saliva and poison as it entered, you know, Pete's body?
Good question.
Like it clearly says on the screen, new species created. And you're like, how did it know?
I do think that there are a lot of things about this movie that it's really important to situate this movie in its historical context, right? So we've talked about how this movie is the first kind of a major studio superhero movie along with X-Men post Batman and Robin. So it's going to have some of that campiness that we don't necessarily see today. But I also think it's really important to remember that this movie came out a year, not even a year, after 9/11. And this is a superhero movie that's set in New York City. Like, Peter Parker famously lives in New York City. He does not live in, like, a metropolis. It's a real, you know, thriving city. And I think it's really important to see how they portray New York in this movie because, you know, in like in the original trailer for Spider-Man, the Twin Towers are in the background. And, you know, obviously they had to digitally remove that and they didn't use that shot in the final movie. But it's really important, I think, for this movie to show a very clean, very happy, very strong New York. And there's even like that scene at the end where they're throwing stuff at the Green Goblin off the bridge and saying, like, you mess with one of us, you mess with all of us. Like, you know, patriotism and like joining with New Yorkers were at an all-time high at this point. And I do think it's really important to not forget that historically, you know, when this movie came out.
Yeah, I mean, 2022, 2021, where we're at right now, you know, patriotism isn't, it's not quite the bee's knees the way it was back in 2002. So, like, to see those things and understand the world that we were living in back then, to know what New Yorkers had been through, to understand the sense of pride that people took in, like, being kind to one another and caring for one another after this major tragedy, I think it's just helpful to appreciate some of those things that feel a little bit cheesy that actually, honestly, I think it's an example of, like, cinema is assisting in, like, yeah, let's build a little bit of American pride. Let's try to gather one another together and, you know, point towards something that would be the ideal.
Yeah, and I don't even know, like, there are very obvious movies that I would point to as being, like, kind of propaganda for America. I don't think this movie would fall into that, but I do think that it's important to note, like, the way they portray New York is very purposeful. They're not portraying it like it's a 1970s crime film, like Joker. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're not going to show, like, drug addicts and homelessness. And they're showing a very pristine version of New York City because, like, literally at this point, Ground Zero is still getting dug out. Like, this movie comes out, I think, in May of 2002. Like, they're still sifting through the aftermath of this national tragedy. And I think to show New York as this kind of, like, behemoth again is a thing that is a very purposeful intention on the part of the filmmakers. But at the same time, you know, I mentioned it's important to put it in historical context. It's also important to note that in 2002, having someone come out on stage and say, "Let's hear it for Macy Gray," was a big deal, apparently, because I don't think I've heard about Macy Gray in 20 years, Brad.
I honestly have no idea who that is.
She had like one big song. It was called "I Try." You should look it up after this episode. You might remember it.
All right.
From Canton, Ohio, Macy Gray.
Oh, come on, fellow Ohioan.
Yeah, there
Let's
it is.
Go. Dude, a note that I took was that in the campier moments of this movie, I think one of the most brilliant things they did was that for me, the campiest of all campy parts of this film was the bone saw wrestling scene. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it almost just makes sense because WWE wrestling is like the most purposeful, campy, real world thing ever created.
Yeah.
So it's almost like it's like reverse camp. Like,
right.
Like the camp in the movie is no longer campy because of how campy the subject matter actually is.
Well, and it's also really interesting just to see kind of like how we were portraying things in 2002 in a way that we probably wouldn't now. And this is not to get like preachy or moralistic, but like WWE is not as big as it was. And so like the idea of pro wrestling being in this movie, it's a no-brainer. It was huge then. Like The Rock had just come out of WWE. Stone Cold was still a big thing in 2002. And like having every female character in this movie wear like a crop top so that their midriff is hanging out was a big thing in 2002. And now it's like, wow, she's supposed to be a child. I do not know how I feel about this, you know?
Yeah, dude, I just really want to bring up the fact that Bonesaw and like is one of the greatest characters in any superhero movie.
I think you need to say it the way he says it, though.
Bonesaw. Dude, and I love that they brought like country hillbillies into the audience and they have big like cutout saws that they're like fake sawing their arms with.
I think I was just pleased to know that like Randy Macho Man Savage just talks like that. Like
all the time.
He had the opportunity to take this character in any direction he wanted, and he just chose to do Randy Macho Man Savage with a new name.
Yep.
He could have done like a German accent. No, my man just went out there and did snap into a Slim Jim.
Yep. What was he supposed to get there and go, oh yeah, my name is Bonesaw. I snap you in half, little spider.
That's what we really need is like a Christoph Waltz as Bonesaw. While we're on that subject, Brad, I have a recasting possibility here. I want to hear your thoughts on it.
All right.
Now, again, Toby is my Spider-Man, like limitations and all. But just kind of knowing that he's a little bit older than he should be, especially by Spider-Man 3. It's like, dude, you're like over 30 now. You need to let this go. What would we think about Elijah Wood as Peter Parker?
In 2002?
In 2002. Like, I know he's doing Lord of the Rings, but he has
he's in New Zealand for like 7 years.
He has like slighter build that Peter Parker is supposed to have. He's like a short little guy. I think he has that boyishness. I think he can do the kind of like shy, reserved thing and make it come across less creepy than it does sometimes with Toby. I don't know. I like the idea of Elijah Wood.
I don't dislike the idea of Elijah Wood. I just have honestly never seen him in anything but Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to imagine Frodo as Peter Parker, but I'm sure that Elijah Wood could have pulled it off. I think you are right in saying that he had that young boyishness, and if anything, I think it would have aged better that he just always looks young.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe he could have kept the franchise going a little longer. It would have been fascinating to see what he could have done with Spider-Man 3.
I don't think anyone could have saved Spider-Man 3.
Yeah, it was a bit of a train wreck at that point, which is so sad because Spider-Man 2, oh my gosh, dude. Mm.
Primo.
Man.
Mm. We'll get to that one of these
so
days.
Good.
All right, my last notes here, Brad, are kind of technical things. And one thing that I really noticed watching this movie was that it has an honest-to-goodness score.
Yeah.
This has great, great... I think it's a Danny Elfman score, if I'm not...
I was going to say, it's a holdover from, you know, the Batman of the 90s. Yeah.
And, like, even when, you know, Spider-Man rescues that trolley car full of kids, and they just go into that, like, superhero-y theme. And I'm like... damn it, like they don't do this with Marvel anymore. The only time you ever got that was every once in a while in an Avengers movie, and they'd play that Alan Silvestri Avengers theme, which was really cool the first time around. But like, when was the last time you listened to an MCU soundtrack? Like, I don't remember any scores from an MCU movie except for that Avengers theme.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you build an entire, you know, 10 plus year universe around one group of characters, then you're kind of stuck with the leitmotif that you create for those characters,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I'm with you, man. The opening credits for this movie, the score is just fantastic.
Yeah.
The sound for this movie was really over the top. I think Danny Elfman did a spectacular job.
And you're right to call it the sound, too. It wasn't just the soundtrack, but like even in that last fight with Green Goblin and Peter, where they're kind of fighting in that like abandoned building or whatever you want to call that area. And he throws that bomb and it kind of blows off part of Peter's mask, and they do the slow motion like sound effects. The sound design in this movie is just so, so good. Like I will say, for as campy as this movie gets, the final 15, 20 minutes of this movie are like unimpeachable to me in terms of superhero stuff. Like it's just perfect superhero filmmaking.
Yeah, I mean, from Norman telling Peter, you know, don't tell Harry, to the way that James Franco confronts Spider-Man as he, you know, lays his father's body on the couch, even to the funeral scene, man. There, I have so many feels going on when Peter's like, listen, I have a responsibility and I can't commit to you right now.
Mm-hmm.
That like there is so much going on there that for me it sets the stage of what a superhero movie should look like. And I really think that's why I chose Spider-Man for my list, is because I literally can't imagine all of the last 20 years of superhero mania, madness, mm-hmm. without this Spider-Man.
Well, let's use that as a segue into our final scores. I'm anxious to hear what you think of this one. Because again, you chose this movie, but watching it as a 31-year-old now, like, where are you coming out on this one?
I think that what I just said is true, but that doesn't mean it's a 10 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I'm going to give it an 8.5 out of 10. I think that there's a lot of beautiful things going on here between the music, the sound design, the acting, the story. The moment with Uncle Ben in the car is one of my favorite movie moments of all time. So there's a lot going on here, but in the end, Bob, it's a little bit rough around the edges. Mm-hmm. There's some stuff going on that you're like, I don't know where that's coming from. It's 2 hours, probably could have been about an hour and 40 minutes. So there's definitely issues with this movie, but don't let any of that take away from the fact that this is the progenitor of modern superhero movies, and you need to go watch it if you haven't seen it.
I think I'm going to give it a 7.5 out of 10. And the 7.5, I don't think is indicative of how I feel about the movie. Like, within the superhero genre, I think this is like a 9 out of 10. This is like one of my favorites. I do think Spider-Man 2 is probably a better movie. But like, when you're just grading it on the curve of like, as a film, how good is this movie? It's like a 3-star movie. It's super enjoyable. There's some really great filmmaking craft going on here. But yeah, I mean, it has its drawbacks and it's a little bit dated. It's a fun movie. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I'm really glad I got to watch it again, Brad. And I thank you for that. So I'm coming out to a 7.5. You're coming out to an 8.5. That brings us to an average of an 8 out of 10. But we'd like to know what you think. So please get on social media. Let us know what you think about the original. I don't even want to call it the original. The 2002 Spider-Man. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Film Whiskey.
Or if you want to converse with us directly, jump onto our Discord. We have a blast talking with all of our listeners. You can find a link to our Discord in every single one of our show notes.
All right, Brad, it is time for me to pick the next movie we'll be reviewing on Film and Whiskey. So hit me with those wheel sounds as I do the randomizer here.
Bro, this is the worst part of every episode. You do realize that, right?
The best thing is I could just reuse the first one you did, but I like making you do it every week. So, well, that was half-hearted. All right. Oh, we're going to stay in the superhero genre. We're going to be watching probably my favorite MCU movie, Brad, Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Bro, I remember watching Guardians of the Galaxy 2 and being like, oh, yep, MCU's starting to go downhill, man.
Oh, then I'm excited to talk about it with you because I feel the complete opposite. So join us for Guardians 2 next week. But until then, I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And we'll see you next time.